To order, and Representative, the minutes are before us. And Representative Bigger moves the minutes. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, we're now going to a bill which I know some of you have heard before. Representative Filpi, you present House File 160. And explain why we need to do this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 160 is, in essence, a one-sentence bill which authorizes the Secretary of State, after written notice to every conceivable party of interest, to transfer within the have a fund account funds that were dedicated to particular purposes within that account to other purposes, as the bill outlines. The reason for that, basically, Madam Chair and members, is that when the state received the HAVA funds and we were contemplating how they would be used, there was being that this was a brand new undertaking, there was some question about what kind of what level of funding would be required for the various activities that would need to be undertaken and to comply with the HAVA law. And there was a great deal of concern about many of the county and municipal elections officials about how that money would be spent, and they wanted to be sure that there was enough funding provided for all of the purposes that they anticipated. So we did try to anticipate how the funds would be used and establish the various purposes that were spelled out in statute. As it turns out, Madam Chair, some of those allocations were not needed at all, and others required a lot less funding than was anticipated. Some of it is just a matter of timing. In other areas, it's more a question of whether it was needed at all for that particular purpose, particularly the funding within the account established to deal with complaints, since there were only two or three very minor ones that didn't require any use of the funds whatsoever. That's the essence of the bill, Madam Chair, and I have with me Ms. Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office that can answer any questions that members might have.
What is the proper motion for this bill? Does it go
Okay. Motion. So Representative Filpi moves that House File 160 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance.
Are you sure?
I think
that's right, Madam Chair.
I don't quite understand this, what we do in terms of when they just send us things and we refer them back, or do we just send them back or whatever? We'll do whatever the motion is to get it back to the Finance Committee.
That's my understanding, Madam Chair.
And then they send it to the, and they'll send it to the floor, I guess.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So that's the motion. That's the motion that's before the committee. Do we need to hear anything from the Secretary of State's office, or are there any questions from members of the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a brief question for Representative Hilty. I know in dealing with this whole HAVA nightmare sometimes that frequently we've heard from the townships and the counties. Do they have a position on this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill Forrest, yes, they do. They are in support of this bill. It's actually a concern of theirs that this bill be passed. What would be allowed in this transfer basically is a lot more focus on sort of the final steps in getting the state voter registration system fully functioning, and that's really the major concern that everyone has currently.
Madam Chair, just to follow up and represent Bill DeForest's question, and it's not pertaining to this bill of appropriations, Representative Hilty, but when townships were mentioned, I know that we had a interest of, or some had an interest of exempting townships from some parts of the HAVA law and allowing townships to be able to have their March elections separate from the November general election. I think 3 years ago we gave townships an extension to 2008, if I remember correctly, which I would like to see a permanent exemption for townships. Can you tell me where we are with that right now? I don't think anything passed last year. I think we're still in that 2008 time frame. And can you just refer to me where we are right now in relationship to township and township board?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Swiggan, that's correct. Nothing did pass in the last session, although we had worked out a compromise that failed to be included, partly because of the recalcitrance of the author, but that's another question. I have had conversations with Mr. Sewell, who's representing the townships. I spoke with him a couple weeks ago about this issue. And the association apparently has agreed not to pursue anything further on this issue in this session. Many of them are in process of changing their township elections from the spring to the get them into the fall election cycle. I did express to Mr. Sewell my willingness to work with the townships to try to find whatever solution that ultimately they decided was necessary, but that's sort of where it stands at the moment. They're not advocating anything further at the moment.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I may try to advocate for them, but I can see kind of a little handwriting on the wall, too, in relationship to maybe votes that are there and not there. But if they don't pursue anything this session, that 2008 date is going to come and go. Because if you don't do something this session, we certainly won't pass anything by the town elections in 2008, and the planning process would be finished, I would guess. So thank you for the background. I will certainly approach the Townships Association myself, or maybe even just advocate for individual townships who don't want to get thrown into this big quagmire of the HAVA voting law and everybody voting on November. We kind of like our little township elections where we get 13, 14, 15 people that will show up, and we run a pretty good government out there.
Madam Chair, Representative Swiggum, it was precisely my awareness of the deadline that caused me to ask Mr. Sewell to come and talk to me about the township issue. And I think part of what remains to be resolved at this point, and you should probably talk to Mr. Sewell or someone else from the association about that, but it's a question of what kind of cost is involved. I think one of the questions was initially what kinds of problems we might encounter just with the handling of the machines. And I think that was a pleasant surprise for many people that anticipated the worst and found out that went fairly well. As far as the cost is concerned, that is a major issue, and actually hoping that we will be able to deal with that aspect of it at some point. But the estimates that I have heard, and this is from Mr. Sulem, representing Swagum, is somewhere between $79 and $800, which is a pretty good range. And his feeling was that if it turned out to be a fairly nominal cost in the programming for the local elections, that it would find that a lot more tolerable than if it turned out to be at the highest ends of that range.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, and this is an appropriation bill, I guess, appropriating some of the HABA account that is left. Are there any monies in this bill that would help those townships purchase that equipment for that $77 or $79 or whatever it was, our intent of last year or a couple of years ago? Are any of these monies flowing that direction? And, you know, it's kind of a crass statement that it's very inappropriate, I'm sure, but it almost seems like we're buying off people, we're buying off the townships to make sure that they aren't pushing legislation, which some people don't like. We're going to make sure that we buy them off. I don't. Maybe that's just the wrong statement, but I get that feeling.
Representative Peer, Representative Swigum, I'm not sure how that would work. Certainly, it has been my intent to work with the townships very closely, and I think that I have been for the last couple of years on this issue. The expenditure in question at this point is not for equipment. They already have the equipment. The question is whether they're required to use it in the local elections. And so the funding concern is for programming costs and printing costs, not for the equipment itself. And Ms. Fraser could probably answer the question about what funds might currently be applicable for that purpose better than I can.
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Mr. Speaker, my name is Beth Fraser, and I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Office of the Secretary of State. In terms of these funds, because the legislature was very prescriptive, none of them could be used for to help townships. But these funds are just through the end of this fiscal year, so they expire at the end of June. There will be a couple million dollars left in the Help America Vote account that you all will have the opportunity to appropriate as part of the 08-09 budget. And we have been in conversation with Mr. Sulem about the township's needs and possibly creating some sort of contingency fund if the cost to townships substantially exceeds the expected cost. So we are in conversation with the townships and the counties and cities about their ongoing costs and how it makes sense to best use the funds.
So thank you for that, Madam Chair. Thank you for putting up with my questions.
No, Representative Swigum and members, I had asked a couple of questions about this bill of, you know, should we extend the amount past the expiration date and that kind of thing. And the answer, and I gather other people asked, should we have these very specific categories? Shouldn't we just have one long run-on sentence of all the things that we're able to do? And the answer is, all of that can fit into the regular budget bill. We need to get this going to get the money so it can be used, and the and all of those changes would, which
and
might make a certain amount of sense.
After serving with you for a number of years, I know that you would not allow a run-on sentence unless it happened to be an amendment you were drafting on the House floor on the run. Then you had a few run-ons, if I remember.
Actually, Representative Stigham, you and I are maybe the only two people around here who will remember the masterpiece when Annie Carlson was governor and was looking for things to veto in the Health and Human Services bill under the authorship of Lee Greenfield, and apparently that bill was one complete 700-page run-on sentence. There was no separate line that could be vetoed. So the studies of government manipulation, I suggest that that bill be looked at. I'm sure someone can pull it out. And I remember when he was vetoing other things and other bills, he did make this comment about that he was really stopped from going after the things he really wanted. And that, I assure you, that was not an accident. Okay. Any other questions about this bill? Okay. Then Representative Pilkey renews his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and transferred, will use to finance, because I don't think it's ever left it. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Okay, we now have two reports that we're going to be looking at. Start, I guess, with Mr. Nobles. And we're going to start with the post-employment benefits for public employees.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and it's good to be back with you. I think some of you in other committees have already had an opportunity to review at least one, if not both, of these reports, but I think they are interesting and complicated and compelling enough that you might be interested to hear that presentation again. Madam Chair, this first report is a lot about how we should account for long-term liabilities in government. As you know, the legislature and most legislative policy-making bodies in government appropriate money, and that money is then spent on a cash basis. And so basically, budgeting in government is on a cash basis. But because you can do a lot of things in terms of moving money around, the financial institutions and the credit rating agencies want an end-of-the-year financial report according to generally accepted accounting principles, where you have to comply with a standard set of accounting principles and standards. Those are established by the Government Accounting Standards Board. This was created back in the 1980s in response to a number of concerns about governmental accounting and some inability of some governmental units, particularly large cities, to stand behind their debt, to stand behind their bonds. And so to assure that they had a full and accurate picture of government financial conditions, they really required state and local governments to establish a mechanism for having generally accepted accounting principles. And this organization, often referred to as GASB, the Government Accounting Standards Board, is particularly concerned that we fully disclose our liabilities. GASB for a long time has had standards on pension accounting, but more recently they've also been setting standards for other long-term liabilities that government has established, so-called other post-employment benefits for public employees. So we're going to first talk about where we measure up, where our statewide pensions measure up in terms of their current financial conditions. And one of the issues that we'll raise, which I'm sure you've already heard about, is the post-retirement fund and the deficit there and how we have not been properly accounting for that deficit. And there are also some policy issues that we need to consider. And then we will go on to talk about the other post-employment benefits that we more currently are needing to account for. Jody Hauer was the manager of this evaluation, and I'll turn it over to her to give you more of the details. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nobles.
Ms. Hauer. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jody Hauer. I work with the Legislative Auditor's Office. As Jim Noble suggested, the report that I'll be describing to you really has two main parts, one having to do with the pension system, the second having to do with benefits other than pensions, but we'll start with the pensions. Overall, in our work on Minnesota public pensions, we found that there are some problems with the post-retirement investment fund. As you may know, the post-retirement investment fund is not a separate pension plan. It's a pooling of assets that come to that post-retirement fund whenever one of the members of the statewide pension plan retires. Now, this post-retirement investment fund currently has a $4 billion deficit, which I'm going to talk about in more detail in just a moment. We also found problems, though, with the formula that's used to increase benefits for retirees. and we think it has a couple of different problems. One has to do with the fact that the formula does not prevent deficits from occurring in the post-retirement fund. And the second problem is that it does not align benefit increases well with inflation or protect from inequities among cohorts of employees. Now, I'll talk about each of these, but let me start by going to the deficits. We look first at what's reported to be the financial condition for the statewide pension plans, and these are the plans that are managed by the three organizations that I'm sure are familiar to you: it's the Public Employees Retirement Association, or PERA, the Teachers Retirement Association, TRA, and the Minnesota State Retirement System, MSRS. Now, part of our analysis for each of the statewide plans that they oversee was looking at their funding ratio, which is just a comparison, the ratio of the fund's assets to its liabilities. And we found that the funding ratios that are reported in those actuarial studies most recently completed for these statewide plans actually make those plans appear better funded than they really are. Now, the problem is that the funding ratios are misleading because they do not value the post-retirement fund's assets at a market value. Assets are supposed to be valued on the basis of a market-related value if they are to conform with the governmental accounting principles that Jim Nobles alluded to. But the value of the assets in the post-retirement fund is not market-related. Instead, actuaries assume that the assets of the post fund equal the estimated liabilities, even though in fact we know, as of the last round of actuarial studies, that the assets are really $4 billion less than the liabilities. Now, this is done in large part because of actuarial standards that were set and adopted by the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Those standards require actuaries to set the post-retirement fund's assets equal to that fund's estimated liabilities. And there are some statutory ambiguities that also add to this problem. Now, when we look at the statewide pension plans actuarial evaluations completed as of June 30, 2006, we found the amount of their unfunded liabilities, which is their deficit, and we looked at their funding ratios. And the table on this particular slide will show you what you would find if you look at those actuarial valuations. The first row refers to PERA's Public Employees Retirement Plan. That's the plan that encompasses the largest number of local government employees. All the statewide plans have a deficit. PERA's Public Employees Retirement Plan happens to have the largest deficit right now, $4.2 billion, a funding ratio of 75%. Now, you have to know that in the last 2 years, the legislature made some changes that would increase the amount to be contributed by both employers and employees to these statewide pension plans. And with these additional contributions, all the statewide plans will become fully funded, or nearly so, by certain target dates that are set in statute. And the last column in this particular table shows you the target dates for the three largest of these statewide plans. So you see that anywhere between 2020 and 2037, all of these plans should be nearly fully funded. The problem with that, however, is that those funding ratios in the actuarial evaluations do not tell us the whole story. As I said earlier, the market value of those post-retirement fund assets is not used in calculating the funding ratios. As a result, those funding ratios in the actuarial studies make those funds appear better funded than they really are. Now, if the pension plan funding ratios actually were based on the market-related value of the assets in that post-retirement fund, then the funding ratios would be far less. In fact, anywhere from 6 to 10 percentage points less than what's reported in those actuarial studies. And this second table shows you what the difference is. Again, I direct your attention to the first row, which is the Public Employees Retirement Plan. As I said earlier, if you look at the actuarial valuation, you'll see that the funding ratio is listed at 75%. However, if we were to look at that plan's share of the post-retirement fund deficit, the funding ratio drops to 68%. And similarly, for each of the statewide plans, there would be a reduction in the funding ratio if that plan's share of the post-retirement fund deficit were actually included. Now, the legislature has made some changes in the last couple of years, but none of these changes, which were significant, will actually remedy this problem with the $4 billion deficit. Last year, the legislature passed a 5% cap on increases to retiree benefits. That cap will start in 2010. That cap will help avoid future deficits for the post fund, but it's not going to help us with this current $4 billion deficit. Over the last 2 years, the legislature changed the amounts to be contributed by employers and employees to their pension plans. And again, the point there was to get those plans up to full funding or nearly to full funding by those target dates that are set in statute. But you have to understand that these contributions are assets for the active pension plans, not for that post-retirement fund. The assets go to the basic funds. They are not going to affect the retiree assets that are in the post-retirement fund. And as a result, none of the changes that were enacted will correct that $4 billion deficit that now exists. Besides this deficit problem, we found that the formula used to increase benefits for retirees also has problems. Three problems that we specifically identified. First, that the formula does not protect the post-retirement fund against deficits. In fact, the formula increases benefits when investment returns are good, and those increases then become permanent. It does not reduce benefits, though, when investment returns are poor. By not retaining enough earnings in those good years to offset the bad years, the formula puts the post-retirement fund at risk of developing large deficits. The second problem is that the benefit increases are not well aligned with inflation. You have to know that the formula used to increase benefits for retirees has two components to it. One is based on inflation, and that is capped at 2.5% each year. The second component is based on market performance. So if the markets are strong and investment returns are very good, then the amount that the returns exceed what's needed to pay for retiree benefits will go to retiree benefit increases. The graph that I have on this particular slide shows that the benefit increases that have been awarded have not been well aligned with inflation. And I point your specifically to the period roughly between 1997 and 2001. You see there that the benefit increases were much larger than inflation. In fact, they exceeded inflation by 3 to 9 percentage points over that period. So we've got these two problems. First of all, that the benefit formula doesn't help protect against the deficits. Secondly, that the benefit formula is not well aligned with inflation. The third problem is that the formula created some inequities between cohorts of employees who retired. The value of benefits for certain retirees is far larger than it is for others. And I'm particularly looking at, in our analysis, we looked at those who retired in 1990 and the mid-1990s compared to those who retired in 2001 or later. And one of the reasons for that is the size of the benefit increases. From 1996 to 2001, benefits increased an average of 9.2% each year. But employees who retired after July 1st of 2001 have received increases of only 2.5% each year or less. Beyond that, those retirees will continue to receive only 2.5% increases per year for some long as yet undetermined point into the future, as long as the post-retirement fund persists in having a deficit. And we have three recommendations that we make related to the post-retirement fund. First, to properly reflect actual financial conditions, we recommend that the legislature require that the funding ratios for the PERA, TRA, and MSRF retirement plans do reflect the true condition of the post-retirement fund. Second, we think the legislature should develop a plan to fully fund the post-retirement fund. And in the report, we lay out some different ways that could be done. At the same time, we think the legislature should change the formula used to increase benefits. We think what they should do is eliminate the investment-based component and instead enhance the inflation component of that formula. We think that it's important to make these changes together as a package because we think that together they stand a better chance of any kind of a court challenge that might occur. We think that's true because retirees, if this package is passed, that is, if the legislature does both fully fund the post-retirement fund over time and change the benefit formula, that means that retirees would have a better chance of getting benefit increases in the near term. Right now, they're limited to just that 2.5%, as I explained earlier. And, of course, they'll get the enhanced security of a fund that's fully funded. Employers would face reduced risk of future deficits in exchange for making more contributions up front. We don't know whether a package of changes like this would stand a court challenge, but we think that together, when there are these kinds of trade-offs, a solution like this would stand a better chance than a simple reduction in benefits by itself. Now, Madam Chair, I'm going to move on to the second part of the report and briefly talk about the...
Well, maybe we'll just ask if there are any questions on this part first. I have one, and I guess I think it's one of your ones. And I should know this, because I think we... But the issue of keeping the post-retirement fund separate. Suppose we decided that all of these were going to be merged funds. And the other question that I also have, maybe at the same time, is the appropriateness of applying the same standards for public funds as private funds. Just the one thing about public open funds, which I've said all the time, is I said you have these two curves that you're looking at. One is contributions and one is benefits. And we set up our law so that they merge at some point out there. But what we just really need is we just really need to assume that they never get further apart. And really, unless we believe that public government isn't going to exist of some kind, there are always, you don't have to have the same worries as a private company going bankrupt or so forth. Can you talk about both of those? Or?
Madam Chair, to your first question about keeping the post fund separate from the other active standing pension plans. And I mean, one of the possible solutions to the deficit that we talk about is eliminating essentially the post fund, that is bringing it together with each of the standing funds. That is one possible solution. Now, the downside to that, of course, is that it probably would require increased contributions from existing employees, active employees. And some might say, well, why should we as active employees put more into this fund to make up a deficit that actually was benefiting those who are already retired? So, I mean, I think that it's not just a simple thing to say, oh, we're going to just merge the post fund with the respective statewide funds. It certainly can be done, and it is one of the options on the table. But it's got as many trade-offs as other solutions, so it's just not an automatic thing that could easily be accomplished.
And maybe, Madam Chair, I could address one of your other concerns, and that is, why should we be concerned about the funding ratios and the financial condition of these pension funds if government is always going to be here to stand behind those obligations? Well, I think that question really goes to the difference between the way we fund pensions in the public sector and the way, for example, we fund Social Security at the federal level, which is funded really out of current receipts. We fund a substantial amount of our pension obligations through investment earnings, and that relieves a lot of burden from taxpayers. So there's that point, that we need capital to create earnings, and we're losing capital, right? Or we're losing earnings because we have a deficit in the post fund. So it's not only that we have a less than 100% funding ratio in the post fund. We have a $4 billion, or possibly somewhat less because of better earnings recently, but we clearly have a substantial deficit in the post, and that's capital that is not earning a rate of return that could be used to meet the obligations in the future. And I think we ought not to lose sight of that. It's been said by a number of people, for example, that there is no crisis because everybody's not going to retire tomorrow. Well, that's a bit of a false argument because we don't manage public pension funds on that basis. We manage them for the long term, and we accumulate capital, we invest it, so that we can fund these pension obligations over the long term. There's also, I think, an equity question, and that is, if we wait and we expect some future generation to pay for these obligations, then we're sort of shifting the burden. These are obligations that are being created today by people who are employed and people who have retired. And so the closer we get to the current generation, I think the greater the equity is in terms of who should really fund those. So I think that's why this is an issue, not a crisis, but we need to have a plan for figuring out how we're going to fill this hole, which is a hole in the capital that we need to make the earnings to meet these obligations, because there are not new contributions coming in from employees and employers. There's only the earnings and the new people that are coming into the post. But that, according to our best estimates, that alone is not going to get the job done. We would simply need to earn more than is reasonable to expect to fill this hole that is the deficit in the post.
Well, what if we just sort of thinking out loud, which is always dangerous to do, what if we from now on said that there isn't a post fund? So we're not, and then we deal with the hole that's in the existing post fund by obviously one of the ways we've moved is this cap on benefit increases of 5% with the rest of it, you know, going into it. If we repeat those wonderful 22-18% years, wouldn't it fill pretty quickly? Or not, because the post fund is more conservative.
Well, Madam Chair, in terms of investments, you're saying the post-retirement fund is more conservative. I think slightly so, but not considerably so. There isn't a great deal, although there is some difference between the investment strategies there. Although certainly the State Board of Investment could speak better to that than I could. But your question about, well, what if we were to say the post fund really doesn't exist anymore? We're going to, as of today, merge those. That certainly is one option, and it could be done. And it's one of the things that I think will seriously be on the table as a possible solution.
And I think, Madam Chair, there is even a kind of a policy.
I mean, what I'm talking about merging is merging it from the ongoing basis, and then, let you know, so you don't get the argument of that the merger is going to have current employees paying for the benefits of past employees.
Well, Madam Chair, that could be done, but you still have to deal with the $4 billion deficit in some way. Whether that's through state appropriation or through additional employer contributions or additional employee contributions in some way, or a reduction in benefits, which isn't as feasible. But in some way, that hole still has to be filled.
Madam Chair, I know you have representatives from the pension plans here, and I haven't seen your agenda. I don't know if it's your expectation that you hear from them, but I know, and certainly if you want to, they can speak better for themselves, but we've talked to them a good deal about this issue, and this is not a new issue to them. I think some people have just recently recognized it, but they've seen it there for some period of time, and they're working on it. They see it not only in terms of the money, which is substantial as an issue, but also as reaching some sort of a package that their members can support. As Ms. Hauer was referring to, there can be some real conflicts between how this burden needs to be shared between active employees and retired employees, and those are their members, and they need to work that out, and they need to put together a package that can not only withstand a potential legal challenge, but can get through the legislature. So I think what they're going to tell you is that they need some time. I hope it won't be too long a period of time, but they may need some months to put together a package that they can come back and present to you that will solve this problem.
One of the plans that I think wasn't on the summary sheets, but kind of going through the report, on page 57, when you talk about the MRF plan, Minneapolis Employees Retirement Plan, you said that the funding ratio of that is 92, but you don't have anything about the MRF post fund. Isn't that a problem to someone?
Madam Chair, you're correct. It also has something that's akin to the post-retirement investment fund, and it's on the same basis, funded on the same basis in that it too, this funding ratio here does not reflect any deficit in that fund for MRF. So if the equivalent of the post-retirement fund for MRF were to be valued at a market-related value, if the assets were, then this funding ratio would also go down. I can't tell you offhand how much.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one point on your question and comment about should we basically get rid of the post and go back to the plans having integrated so that the active and retired members are clearly in the same plan and think of it that way. I think that has some value and it's worth thinking about for this reason. I think one of the reasons we got into trouble is that with a post fund, you take assets and you put them in this post fund, and people who are retired tend to think of those as their assets. And when there were really good earnings on those assets, they tended to think of those earnings as theirs. You're getting more into a defined contribution type pension plan when you think that way, rather than a defined benefit plan. But these are defined benefit plans where people are guaranteed an annuity. Now, I think it's always important that you maintain the purchasing power of retirees. That's why we propose that you look at the inflation adjustment and do away with an investment performance adjustment, because the mistake, I think, that was made conceptually back when the earnings were good is that those earnings belonged to the retirees. Now, the second mistake is obvious. That is, they made a claim on the good years, but weren't willing to ride down with you on the bad years. So if you're truly going to have a defined contribution-type plan where people are going up and gaining, and they've got to be willing to ride down, too, and share the risk and the volatility that exists in those kinds of plans. So, again, it's just giving some support, Madam Chair, to your concept that maybe we ought to be thinking about doing away with the post fund.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, bullets 2 and 3 up there. So can you give us, from your humble position, your recommendation, the specific recommendations that we need to do or should be looking at, or options to address this situation? I will tell you, I'm not quite as alarmed. I met with the pension funds just this week. I'm not quite as alarmed as I was previously when I just heard $4 billion. There is a plan. It doesn't look like the deficiency is as bad as some portray it to be. But give me your politically realistic recommendation, knowing that if we maybe did what we should do, we'd be doing from a prudent taxpayer standpoint, half the people sitting here wouldn't get elected because they'd be kicking off all their constituents. On the other hand, if we don't do anything, we probably put ourselves into a very difficult financial situation into the future. I'm reminded, I think, wasn't it this last summer that the mayor of Duluth, the wonderful mayor of Duluth, said he wasn't running for re-election because he needs to act and he needs to act strongly, and there's no way he can get re-elected doing what he needs to do, or something to that effect. If we do what we need to do, we don't get re-elected. Give us a politically realistic recommendation.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative members, I think Ms. Howard can do a better job of that than I can.
I feel like neither of you have to get reelected.
They don't.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, one answer to Representative's question is for that first bullet about appropriate disclosure for the deficit. And there what we're saying is that we should value the assets of the post-retirement fund at a market-based value. I don't think that that is a politically troubling...
Sorry, that's not going to cause anybody to pain one way or another.
Exactly.
If the bullet's 2 and 3.
Well, for fully funding the post-retirement fund, again, it depends on sort of what you think is most feasible. It could be something that you want to do correct in 10 years or perhaps in 20 years or even longer. And, of course, the longer you would set your target date for correcting the deficit, the smaller amount you put in, but then there are some risks with that.
Madam Chair, what you know what we'll do here if we don't have the political strength is what they'll say. We're going to we have a plan to do it for 10 years, and then we'll just say when that 10-year period comes, we'll make another 10, another 10, and we'll just keep pushing off the actuarial assumptions.
Except here, there's one difference, which is if you have this sharp cutoff that you have to do it. I mean, that's that may make it harder than it needs to be. In the case of letting it go on for longer, because of the fact it's not a private company, and that we are going to have public employees, and we are going to have firefighters, and we are going to have teachers. You know, letting it take a longer time is not quite as irresponsible as it may seem.
Madam Chair, One of the things that you hear is a recommendation, and I'm going to redeem myself from shifting the burden to the conversation, is that, you know, you did make some corrective action in the active part of the funds. And they have some target dates that we referred to in terms of becoming close to fully funded. They are going to accumulate some assets. And again, I think this is all about assets and earnings. So I think what you're going to hear from them, I don't mean to prejudge the plan they're going to present to you because they're still working on it. But one of the possibilities is that if earnings are good and the accumulated capital in the active funds, it may be a little more palatable to the active members to shift some of those resources to cover the deficit in the post fund for the retirees. Now, and Representative Swigum, although, you know, there are tensions between various interests here, I think that there is an interest on the part of the active members of all the pension funds that this issue be addressed, because at some point they intend to become retirees themselves. And if that's going to be in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, they want the money to be there so that there isn't a crisis, there isn't a concern on their part. And you and your colleagues and future elected officials who will sit in your chair 5, 10, 15 years from now also want that to happen so that they don't have to deal with that crisis. So that's one of the possibilities. Again, what we said as a recommendation was that first there ought to be recognition that there's a problem, and second there ought to be a plan. And that plan could have various elements. And I think probably the one that is going to turn out to be the most palatable is that we grow our way out of this to some degree, but not grow our way out of this just based on the assets that are in the post fund. That we use some of the earning power of the assets that are in the active funds as well. So that the solution to the post deficit is not out of contributions from active members. It's out of earnings on the assets. That, I think, will... you asked me what might be the most politically acceptable. That's the best I could probably come up with. It probably wouldn't get me elected, but I think that that's a way of sharing a solution that doesn't require active members to make contributions out of their paychecks.
Madam Chair, if I could add just one thing, and that is, as long as the post-retirement fund has a deficit, the increases to the benefits for the currently retired folks will be limited at 2.5%. So if you say we're going to fix this problem over the next 20 years, that means over the next 20 years, each year, those benefit increases will be limited to 2.5%. And could not go any higher than that. So that's one of the things that's a trade-off. If you say we're just going to keep extending the time for which we would be trying to correct the problem.
Okay, I think we need to go. I know that plan members do want to say something, but maybe I think we need to go on to the second part of this one, and then we'll ask for. Then we'll get some comments from plan members. Let's go on to, and if we don't finish the firefighters, we'll take that up at our next meeting. So, but.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to go through the rest of this a little bit more quickly. The next part of this presentation has to do with those post-employment benefits other than pensions, commonly called other post-employment benefits. Some of you have heard the term OPEB. That's what I'm going to be talking about now. It's chiefly health insurance for retirees. It can include life insurance. It can include dental and vision packages. But really, the medical insurance is really the driving force here. We do not yet have estimates on the full liability statewide, but we do know that for about 24 communities where the actuarial studies have already been completed, the estimated liability is $1.5 billion over the next 30 years. Now, these benefits are coming to the fore, as I already mentioned, mostly health insurance. They're coming to the fore now chiefly because of the Governmental Accounting Standard Board requirements that are going into effect. the requirements apply to these benefits and are being phased in over a three-year period, starting this year for the largest governments. Any local North Haven employer who provides other post-employment benefits will be required to have a study conducted by an actuary. That study will then estimate what the size is of the liability for that jurisdiction in terms of these other post-employment benefits. Now, in Minnesota, only a limited number of jurisdictions offer other post-employment benefits to their employees. There was a study last year by the state auditor that estimated about 1 in 5 local jurisdictions, including the very small townships, offer other post-employment benefits. This chart shows you that the school districts and counties were far more likely than cities or special districts to offer other post-employment benefits to their employees. State employees, only a very small portion of state employees receive, are eligible for the benefit. Last year, about 5% of state pensioners were among those who do get employer-paid health insurance at retirement. State Highway Patrol, some correctional officers, and a few others. Now, most jurisdictions that pay for other post-employment benefits do not offer to all employees. It's usually a subgroup of them. They don't pay the benefit for the entire lifetime of the retirees. It's usually just to age 65 until they become eligible for Medicare. And in most cases, the public employers do not pay the full premium. They pay a portion of it or an amount up to a certain cap. We looked at total spending of local governments to see how much of their total spending and all their services was accounted for by these other post-employment benefits. For most local jurisdictions, it was less than 1% of their total spending. But we did note that there were several who had much higher rates of spending. There were 11 cities and school districts that had more than 5% of their total spending go to these other post-employment benefits. And these were all located up in northeastern Minnesota. Now, the liabilities that we already know about are for the 24 communities that have completed actuarial evaluations. I already said it's about $1.5 billion over the next 30 years. We estimate that that amount of liability will roughly double by the time the remaining jurisdictions have completed their actuarial evaluations. 26% of local governments that offer other post-employment benefits have set aside money to pay for these benefits that are now accruing. Statewide, though, the amount set aside is far less than what's going to be required to fully fund the liabilities. Public employers are not required by these Government Accounting Standard Board requirements to reserve money to pay for the post-employment benefits, but there are advantages to doing so. If they do try to pre-fund the benefits, it means, of course, that the money's there when the portion of their workforce that is at retirement age does actually retire and gets the promised benefit. And for another thing, it means that the taxpayers today who are receiving the services being currently provided are paying for those benefits instead of pushing the cost for those benefits off onto future taxpayers. Now, we learned that most jurisdictions do not now have plans to reserve money in advance to pay for these other post-employment liabilities. But for those who do want to pre-fund and those who want to reduce their unfunded liability, the standards, that the accounting standards require that they do that through an irrevocable trust. Now, that doesn't mean they can't reserve money in other ways. They can. But if they want to have the actuary count the money that they're setting aside against their liability and reduce their unfunded liability, they have to, by these, according to these standards, do it with an irrevocable trust. Now, last year, both the state auditor's office and the attorney general's office raised questions about whether local governments have legal authority to establish these trusts. Because this matter is in dispute, we think the legislature should make a change, and what we recommend is that the legislature do allow local jurisdictions to establish these trusts. We think also that statutes should specify who has legal title to the assets in the trust, and that the statutes should also prescribe what are the fiduciary duties for the trustees who would be overseeing the money that's in those trusts. We believe that local governments who establish these trusts should have the option of having the State Board of Investment manage that money if they choose, but we don't think that that is something that necessarily should be required of any and all local governments who decide they want to set up a trust. With that, Madam Chair, I will complete my remarks. My final slide is just a summary of what we've already said. I think I would probably go to questions if you have any about this section of the report or on the pension.
Okay. Any questions from Ms. Hunt? Mr. Sellers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was on the last part, but it also fits this part as well. I was looking at some of the the aging workforce, life expectancies, the contributor side, as you were discussing. And looking around the table, I see some of my colleagues here are going to be contributors. I include you, Madam Chair, that will probably contribute another 20, 25 years of service and work. The concern, and especially the chart on page 9 and also the 1-3, the life expectancies that we're looking at post-retirement, in the 80s it was about 17 years, we're up to 19 years now. How are we accounting for, or is that one of the deficiencies in how we're accounting for some of those retirees that are going to be taking those benefits at a much longer time, a much longer period, and based on some of these historical increases that, you know, common sense really don't make, didn't make any common sense.
Well, one quick correction is that most of the people you're looking around at, with the possible exception of Representative Stigham and me, are all in defined contribution plans, and so they're not causing any problems with state government.
I stand corrected, Madam Chair. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think the charts that you point out are especially relevant for the health insurance piece of the study that we talked about today, because right now we don't know yet what the full liability is because the actuarial studies have not been completed for most jurisdictions around the state. But once those studies are underway and when they're completed, we'll have a much better handle on this. One of the reasons that we included those charts was to show that there really is some urgency here, just because a fairly large proportion of the workforce is getting to that age when they will be looking at retirement in just a few years. So for those communities that have promised post-retirement benefits, now other than pensions, and have not yet set aside money or have not yet tried to deal with what this is going to mean, it's going to hit home very, very soon for those jurisdictions.
Madam Chair, if I could just add to Representative Zeller's question, and that is, this is why you really want good actuarial analysis. You do want to bring data, and this is one of the concerns we had about the imposed requirement on the actuary to value assets in the post equal to liabilities. That's not good actuarial analysis. So we shouldn't constrain the actuary to use their professional judgment and data and analysis to come up with these numbers. They're still estimates, but they're reasonable and good estimates as long as we let them do their job.
Just one other question, Madam Chair. When you're talking about the investments of each of the funds, and maybe this is the defined benefits versus defined contribution argument, where were the funds being invested? Are we talking mutual funds? Are we talking, you know, and maybe this is because I'm new to the committee and haven't asked these questions before, but it seems to me if you have an idea of what you're paying out, you know, if you're in, you know, market funds, if you're in bills, if you're in whatever, just a, you know, passbook savings account, you'll get 5% over time. So is that part of the problem, that we don't know where they're investing, or each have misinvested or disinvested? Not knowing that benefit going forward, I don't know how you could give out any of those funds you're paying. I don't know who you're investing or what you're investing.
Madam Chair, one of the really good things that we should say about Minnesota and its pensions is that we have a very good state board of investment to invest all of these monies that we're talking about right now. We're going to talk about possibly later some other pension funds that are not generally invested through the state board of investment. But part of the good news is that we have a very professional staff. They get a lot of good investment advice. They're governed by the constitutional officers, and they have very good earnings. And they invest in a wide range of kinds of instruments with very good asset allocations. There are a variety of mix of assets that they invest in. So I don't think that for these is the problem. Obviously, we bear the risk of the marketplace, though, and it can be fairly volatile. But I don't think the investment performance of the State Board of Investment is the issue.
Well, and I think at some point in the course of the committee, not this year, and we will hear from the State Board of Investment about how they operate and
Well, and that leads to my last question, I promise, Madam Chair. And on slide 7, it shows the benefit and then the increase in the inflation. If we know from the State Board of Investment or get an idea of where their investment strategies are going, is there no communication between the two, between the fund and the State Board of Investment as to the market looks like this, or are they not consulting, or do they not have any legislative mandate or requirement to consult back and forth? Because I agree with you, and I've actually seen and heard the wonderful investments that our State Board does, but then are these funds not consulting back with our great advisors to say, where are we going? And maybe that's the problem, that those benefit increases had nothing to do with our great investments.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Zellers, I just mentioned one of the good things about our situation in Minnesota. The next point, I guess, people would debate, and that is the benefit levels are not set by the plans, they're set by the legislature. And so what we've gotten ourselves into is that retirees in the past came to the legislature, lobbied for sharing the benefits, as I said before, on the upside of the market. But you, the legislature, did not have them share the pain going down. So that issue really rests right with you.
Thank you.
Okay, I know that there are some plan members who wanted to say some words. Susan, in the order in which they get up to the front. Okay, if you please say who you are for the committee members and for the tape.
Sure. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
My name is Mary Bannick. I'm the director of Public Employees Retirement Association.
Okay. And Lori, you're just hanging around?
Retirement Association.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll just start today with a little bit of introduction.
Okay.
And first of all, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to discuss the audit report today. And we actually find the OLA report very helpful and supports the policy direction already being pursued by the legislature and the boards of the Minnesota State Retirement System, Teachers Retirement Association, and Public Employees Retirement Association. We do agree that the post-fund deficit is a problem. We agree that it is not a crisis, and it is one that is manageable. As Mr. Nobles mentioned, we have not been hiding anything, and this is not a new problem. Last year, we pursued legislation to put a 5% cap on post-retirement increases, and during that process, we went through very many different hearings, very many different committees, and that was eventually passed into law. We are supportive of the first bullet point that they raised, the accounting changes. And we will have legislation to do that this year introduced. And then the three statewide boards are also meeting to review alternatives for the post fund, including the ones laid out in the audit report. Just to give you a sense of what we're doing, the three boards have formed a joint committee. We are going to ask for input from our active members and our retirees. We plan to put together a comprehensive plan, have actuarial work done, and hopefully have that done this fall. We would then educate our members and have a bill ready for introduction in 2008. So that is with the kind of the steps that we feel that we're moving forward. We do think if we could just take a step back today to put this into perspective and also put some context into the numbers that you're looking at. And with that, we have a handout in front of you. And Madam Chair, it will not take too long to go through this, but I think it's just helpful if we could. First of all, the Minnesota State Retirement System covers state employees, University of Minnesota employees, Met Council employees, and it shows the membership of our plan. We have about 76,000 active members, currently paying about 26,000 benefit recipients. We've got about 24,000 people who have left money with us and someday would be eligible for benefits. We administer many different retirement plans, as listed there. The ones we're going to focus today will be on our general plan, because that's by far our largest retirement plan. And we have assets of $9.8 billion. PERA covers city, county, and non-teaching school employees. They have the largest membership of the three. They have about 158,000 active members, 39,000 deferred members, and they're currently paying about 66,000 benefit recipients every month. And we list their plans as well. And they have about $16.7 billion in assets. Teachers Retirement Association covers teachers at the public schools, state universities, and community colleges. They have about 80,000 active members and currently paying about $45,000. They have the largest asset pool at $17.8 billion. So we have a total, if you add the three funds together, of about $44.3 billion in assets. On the next page, we look at where our money comes from and how it is spent. Our revenue sources that we collect, about 13% comes from employee contributions, 15% from employer contribution, and by far the biggest chunk of our funds come from investment return, about 72%. We are not a pay-as-you-go system like Social Security. We are a pre-funded system. So we get the contributions in, we invest those contributions to have a pile of assets that we would then use to pay liabilities. How we spend our money, about 94% goes out in retirement benefits, 3% to refunds for people who take their money out of the program, 2% for investment expenses, and 1% for our own administrative expenses. That's just an idea of the source. And you talked earlier about investment performance. Just some historical numbers on that for the period ending June 30th of 2006. For the 1 year ending June 30th of 2006, the State Board of Investment earned 12.3%. For our retirement plans, if you look back 3 years, it was 13.2% was the average return. When you look at the 5 year, that brings in those 3 years that we all remember where the markets were very painful and we didn't want to look at our statements and accounts and everybody went through some pain. If you take a longer perspective, for example, on 25 years, our average return has been 11.2%. So over the long term, we have had a very solid investment return.
I'm going to pick up now in the presentation just to give you a little perspective on the creation of the Pulse Fund. It's not a new phenomenon in Minnesota. In 1969, the legislature chose to create what was called the Adjustable Fixed Benefit Fund. And the reason they did that is that because the funds alone were not very well funded, and retirees were concerned about whether or not the assets that to pay their benefits would be available. So a separate portfolio of funds was created at that time to set aside assets for retirees. That fund, as it functioned, did not produce benefit increases in any significant way, shape, or form. There were a couple of legislatively provided increases, but in 1980, a decision was made to modify that fund, and what was created is what we call the Post Fund today. Throughout the 80s, post-retirement adjustments were based upon realized income to that fund. It started out at about 50% equity, 50% fixed, and what happened over time is more people retired and more money needed to be generated. They were selling off stocks, realizing income on the capital gains of stocks, and by the late 1980s, early 90s, 86% of a multi-billion dollar fund was in bonds. And there was concerns about whether or not that type of investment structure would yield the kind of returns they needed to keep the fund whole at 100% and to provide benefit increases. So a new type of adjustment mechanism was created in 1992 and went into effect in 93, passed by the legislature. And that adjustment mechanism allowed the State Board to then put more money into equities. So it is more aggressively invested now than it was throughout the 80s. So what that did, however, though, on the page of charts called Minnesota Post-Retirement Fund, there's a line graph and a bar chart, and they're both basically reflecting the same thing. In the good days of the stock market, the assets in the post fund accumulated quite nicely.
In 1998, we were 134% funded. We had well more in that post fund than what we needed to meet the long-term obligations to pay benefits to the retirees in the fund. We did start at that point in time to talk to legislators about the fact that we were sharing those gains over 5 years. We were spreading any gains that we received by paying out one-fifth of those in each of 5 years. And we thought it prudent to spread that out over a longer period of time. We were proposing 10 years. That didn't go anywhere, so we suggested a modified approach, 7 years and then 10 years as we, you know, transition into it. We didn't do our homework. Our retirees were not happy with us. You heard from them, or those of you who were here, heard from them. They did not support us. The stock markets were strong. There was a lot of money in the post fund. They didn't see what we were concerned about, that a market correction could cause problems. Not only did we have 1 year of market correction, we had 3 years. So we got as low as 76% funded in the post fund in 2003. And as Mr. Noble shared with you, through investment earnings alone, we have now recovered to 84.5%. When we started talking about a 5% cap on increases in 2005, which was passed last year, we did share with people that we spoke to that we knew that the 5% cap was not a fix. It wasn't going to put any more money into the fund, but if we ever grew out of this to the point where we could again be 100% in sharing gains, we didn't want to overshare as we did in the past. So we were aware of that in our discussions with members of the legislature. The 5% cap is not a fix, and we knew that if we didn't make more progress over the next several years in growing out of this, we'd have to come back. And so the legislative auditor's report just helped call more attention to the fact that it does need to be addressed, and we will be working on that and hope to have a proposal for the legislature by next year.
Okay. And I'll just go through this last page, which I believe you've already talked about in some detail. Let's give you some numbers. This is an option that we are looking at very closely and analyzing. It's the option of combining the post and the active funds for each of our separate systems in one fund. This alignment would then cause us to begin to recognize the post-fund deficit within our active fund if we have one fund. A couple of caveats here when you look at these numbers before I go into the detail is that these numbers are based on the assumption that all the contribution rate increases that have been enacted into law are fully implemented. You'll see toward the bottom of the page that there's a phased schedule. They're not really fully implemented until 2007-2010. But these estimates are based on full implementation to give you an accurate long-term picture. And the second modification that's important here is that these assumptions value the active fund at market value as well as the post fund. So both funds would be brought to market value, what they are today. And also it would make some assumptions that the actuaries are suggesting in to lower our salary and payroll. So with that being said, let me just go through the numbers. For MSRS, you can see that currently under the baseline scenario, their funding ratio is 96.2%. They're currently running a very slight deficiency of 0.1%. If for MSRS there would be a combination of the active and post funds, you would see that their funding ratio would decline to 92.6%, but they would still have roughly the right amount of contributions that they need to fund the plan over 20 years. They would still have a slight deficiency of 0.1%, which is relatively small. PARA, their current funding ratio is 74.7%. They're not running a deficiency. They're just right at where they need to be currently to fund their plan over a 26-27-year amortization period. If the active and post were merged, their funding ratio would decline somewhat to 71.9%, but they still over that long-term horizon would be adequately funded. TRA, the last column, the news is not as good, unfortunately. We currently stand at a 92.6% funding ratio. That would decline, if we combine funds, would decline to 86.8%, leaving us with a fairly sizable deficiency of 1.7% of payroll. That is significant. So if we went down this route, this option of merging the active and post funds, TRA would need to be looking for some additional revenue, some contribution rate increases or other sources of revenue in order to be balanced financially over that 30-year horizon and attainable funding. So just to reiterate, PARA and MSRS could absorb the post-fund deficit without any radical significant changes in their funding structure. But for TRA, in order to, for us to absorb the deficit, we're close to half of the post-fund deficit. $2 billion of that $4.9 billion is TRA's shortfall. We would need some financial adjustments to be able to absorb that. So with that, I'll end and just call your attention. There's a map attached to our handout that shows you that the Post Fund is a very significant source of income for Minnesota retirees. We pay out over close to $2.4 billion annually, and you can see the county-by-county breakdown. So it's important. It's a source of economic stimulus.
Okay. Well, obviously not, and it must have been obvious to people some time ago, and I'm sorry I didn't say it, going to get to the firefighters' pension fund today. So we will get that on our next one. And we do have, oh, but first let me ask if there are any questions of these three. Ms. Representative Bigham?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have, one that draws attention to a major problem with the baby boomers about to retire, and this is just one more effect that we're going to have to deal with and soon. My question is, the rates that you are providing here, is that based on current trends of how they've been in the past years? I mean, theoretically, what would happen if we have a big boom, like we're getting 18%, you know, return on our... Is it with this, we would have a different story, and vice versa. If all of a sudden the market tanks really bad and we're getting a 4% return. So this really is, I mean, this is still kind of rolling the dice.
Madam Chair, I think what we're looking, we assume we're going to earn 8.5%. So I'll start with that. Clearly, if we earn more, we get fully funded more quickly on average. If we don't earn that, we would then fall behind. What we look at is we're a long-term business. We've been in existence since 1929. Over time, any 25, you know, the 25-year period, we've earned over 11%. So I think the 8.5% is realistic, but you were right. The markets go up and down. We have been, for the most part, been able to ride those ups and downs. Our funding improved dramatically in the 90s. And then it dropped, and you know, so over the course of time, it does have an impact. But again, long term, we think it's sustainable.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much. Jill, we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you.
One more from Comet.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alsweiger, Education, Minnesota. I only want to comment briefly on the possible solution of merging the active fund and the post fund and what it will mean to our active teachers. Currently, if a teacher is teaching, their retirement money goes into the active fund. Once they retire, the money then goes into the post fund. Between 1996 and 2001, which was previously stated, the retirees and their money was in the post fund received significant increases because of the interest earnings. And as a result of that, their higher benefits that they received then carried on through the years, and now we have a deficit in the post fund. That is some debt created by the retirees. If you merge the active fund with the post fund, what you are really doing then is saying that the active teachers are going to be paying the debt of the retirees. Why is that a problem? First of all, the comment was made very accurately that TRA right now is at 92.6% funded. If you combined it, it would go to 86.8%. This is especially a problem because of where Minnesota teachers stand in terms of their pension benefits. If you look in this report, beginning on page 69, it reports out where Minnesota teachers are when they initially retire. There are a number of factors that are used to determine your initial pension benefit. It starts on page 69, but then if you flip over to page 70, the first paragraph under the table talks about the formula multiplier. And the last sentence says, Minnesota's normal benefit multiplier of 1.7 is lower than the national median below both methods. In fact, there's 34 states that you can compare Minnesota teacher pensions to because we're coordinated with Social Security. We are basically at, I think it's number 28 and number 33 when you look at the two-level benefits. We are near the bottom. The next calculation is the next paragraph, which relates to the high five. It basically says that the high five is tied for last place. I'll be happy to give you some of this documentation. In other words, we certainly could use a pension benefit increase. Going to page 71, they talk about the penalties if you retire before the normal retirement age. Our penalties are some of the most severe. And in that paragraph, the last sentence on page 71, first paragraph, it says, no other plan has a normal retirement age over 65. And the majority of our teachers have an age of 66. In fact, many states have 62. When you go to page 77, they also talk about... they also talk about some of the other benefits that are less generous. But I will just summarize by saying, in addition to what's said here, we are the only state that doesn't have a way to retire prior to age 65 or 66 for those teachers who were hired on or after July 1st of 1989. In other words, the rule of 90. Or some states have 30 years and out or something like that. The employer contribution is not listed, I don't believe, in here. And Minnesota's employer contribution is one of the lowest. I'll tell you one area where we are average or higher, employee contributions. My point is this. Minnesota teacher pension benefits are in serious need of being improved because we are near the bottom of every category except for employee contributions. If you merge these two funds, you are making it more difficult to get pension benefit improvements because you drop that funding ratio from 92% to 86%. I would like to also just say, you know, we think that the fund directors, Lori Hacking, Dave Bergstrom, and Mary Vanek are doing a wonderful job, as is Howard Bicker with the State Board of Investment. And we were willing to work with whatever the plan might be to try to fix it because we realize that there is some fixing that is needed, but not at the expense of the active employees. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yes, I'm interested, and I don't know if you can answer this, but... I think particularly as we're looking at the factors that Representative Bigham brought up about the onslaught of the boomers and the difficulty of replacement, what kind of shape are these plans that have normal retirement at 60 in?
Madam Chair, I really am not versed in the information about other plans except for the information that I shared with you today.
Just instinctively, it would seem to me that there was be getting into some serious problems at this time.
Madam Chair, their employer contributions are significant. Many of them are significantly higher, and so maybe they're able to take care of it. I mean, just to give you an example, Pennsylvania, which is a state that we often compare ourselves to, is a state that is coordinated with Social Security. When they retire, their initial payment when they retire is, I believe, 75% of their salary. That's after 30 years. In Minnesota, it's 46%. So there's a significant difference in what's happening. And we've got two, I want to make sure that I'm clear.
Okay.
There are two different levels of benefits, and so I'm not making that generalization for all teachers. But for those who were hired on or after July 1st, 1989, we have a big problem. And we know the fund directors understand that issue. And when you talk about trying to attract and retain teachers, and they say, I'm going to be doing jumping jacks with first graders till I'm 66 years old, I don't know if I can handle it. Look at the salaries. Our salaries are falling. Our benefits are falling. It's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Any questions?
We will get to the firefighters probably next time. That's maybe a little bit more interesting than interesting with quotes around it than these are. Are there any questions or comments? Okay. Thank you. Thanks for your good attendance and attention to what clearly is not the most exciting part of state government. Meeting adjourned.